You may begin when ready, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nathaniel Skaggs. If I could reserve a 3-minute rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Please. This is an appeal of the Circuit Court of the City of Petersburg. The court has had a chance to review it. There were initially two charges. The only charge that came up before Your Honors for review is the reckless handling of a firearm. I have been practicing law for many years. I do many sufficiency of the evidence petitions for appeal. Unfortunately, they don't always work out. This is one here, though, that when I was arguing, I've received Mr. Stallard's brief to the court. The main thrust of my arguments, obviously, at the trial court, there was a felony pending, so obviously, as you all did when you were in trial practice, you put most of your focus on that. But it's the reckless handling of the firearm is what we're here for. My argument is simply, did the Commonwealth prove what my client, Sequez Diario Jones, had that evening would qualify as a firearm under recklessly handling a firearm? You've had a chance to review, again, what I have written, and it's pretty much a statutory interpretation issue. I went back to the transcript.
Your bottom line argument, if I can maybe streamline it, is that the standard for under 18.2-56.1 regarding the reckless handling of a firearm is different analytically than what would be under 18.2-308.2 when you're dealing with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon.
Well, it'd be analogous to that.
Okay.
Because in that's the case as well. They have to prove that it's a firearm. It's not like the use of, I referenced when I was arguing the case at the trial level, use of a firearm in commission of a felony. I mean, I could stick my hand on my shirt, and if that looks like a firearm, or if it's a toy, or something along those.
So the contrast is 18.2-282. That would be the contrast.
Basically, I think that's the one that I was focusing on. The question is, and I put it in there, could somebody recklessly handle something to endanger life limb that is not a firearm?
So if I understand correctly, at present,
yes, sir,
we have these two standards, one that's a little more forgiving in the
correct
use of the firearm context, for example, and one that's a little more demanding of the Commonwealth in the felon in possession, for example.
Yes, sir.
And so, but you're not advocating for a third or different standard. You're just saying it falls on the one side of the ledger that's more rigorous because of the way the statute is written.
Yes, sir, Judge. Courts always pay attention to the laws. We like to think that it's always going to get to lots of case law equally. However, if you look at the annotations, this court's history in the Supreme Court, it's a lot less than what we see on the others. And in fact, Judge Dalton at the trial level says, I don't believe I've seen a case that goes that far, Mr. Skaggs. When I was arguing this, there's nothing to really say what the firearm means in the context of the statute.
What relevance is it that the defendant admitted that a gun went off that night?
Well, obviously, if he admitted that a gun went off that night, but he had denied that he was the one who had the gun. So we heard shots. It was actually on my cross-examination. The gentleman from the grocery store said that he had heard firearms before. He didn't see it. If you all recall from the transcript, he turns his back. He's walking and hears what sounds like firearms. Here's the pinging off the top of the building, which I personally would have been running for my life at that point. But the appellant did, Mr. Jones, admit that he heard firearms. The question is, though, was it he who was the one who was recklessly handling a firearm? The court, at the motion to strike, obviously we presented further evidence, held that he didn't have a firearm in context of the felon in possession of a firearm. And my client obviously was a convicted felon, so the court didn't, for lack of better words, necessarily buy what he had to say. But again, the standard is, I'm not asking for a third one. The question is, what does firearm mean in context of this statute? I would argue that it's to recklessly handle.
Yes, it seems to me like that you're discussing two different issues. A moment ago, and for the most part of your argument, you were saying that the issue on sufficiency was whether or not the object that the defendant had was a firearm. Then, after you acknowledge that the defendant testified that a gun went off that night, you seem to be arguing whether or not the defendant was the one who had the gun that went off that night.
Well, certainly, that is something that I didn't go far into that because having done this for a while, I know it's always the trial court. The response is generally it's the trial court's interpretation of credibility of the witnesses. So that's why I focused more on what he allegedly had, because the testimony is obviously one saying I didn't have something that looked like it. You have the victim who says he had something that looked like a firearm, resembled that, for purposes of this statute. And what I argued in my motion to strike was that they didn't prove that he had an actual firearm in context that would be analogous to the felon in possession of a firearm.
So the Commonwealth's argument is, well, we don't have to reach the issue of the correct legal standard under 18256.1 because, given the facts before the trial court, the evidence satisfies even the more rigorous standard.
Well, obviously, I know that that's Mr. Stallard's brief. That was the thrust of his argument, kind of the catch-all argument at the end after he responds to me. But still yet, Judge, it is a sufficiency. It was something where it was split up because I did do the motion to strike and then my client did testify. But again, that is what we're here today asking the court to examine what the nature or the definition of a firearm would be in context of this statute.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Stallard.
Good morning. May it please the court. Greg Stallard on behalf of the Commonwealth. As Your Honor noted, basically what the facts of this case are is Mr. Lee followed these individuals outside of a store, used a flashlight, saw Mr. Jones in possession of what he believed to be a gun. He then turned to go back in the store to call
the police. He knows what guns are.
He knows what they are. He then heard a gunshot. He knew it was a real gunshot, and it was very loud. At this point, I think there's enough of an inference given the light most favorable to Commonwealth to indicate that what he saw was a gun, and that gun was discharged when his back was to the defendant.
If we were on a blank slate, I think, it's, you know, if I'm the trial judge, you make that argument, I say it's pretty persuasive. The problem is the trial judge then acquits.
He did.
And so why would we assume the trial court rendered an inconsistent verdict as opposed to just simply, in the absence of case law, use an incorrect standard on applying the statute?
Well, the judge also said, when affirming the reckless handling charge, he said, I credit the Commonwealth's witnesses, which was Mr. Lee. And that's everything that Mr. Lee said I just recited to you. So clearly he credited that testimony and convicted. Now, I understand there's an issue regarding there might be some inconsistencies in what the judge ultimately did. Now, if the court gets to the point where, okay, there may be some discrepancies, I would suggest that it's not a clear cut, it's a use standard or a possession of a firearm standard, because there are items which would not be firearms for purposes of 308.2, specifically BB guns. Because to be a firearm under purposes of possession by a felon, it has to be expel a projectile by means of explosion. BB guns are spring or compressed air. If somebody can be injured by the discharge of a BB gun, just as well as a gun, not as severely, but it's also a risk that you can endanger life, limb, or property. That's the harm the statute's aimed to preclude. So there are items which don't fall under 308.2, which you could still recklessly handle. So
yeah, but it's not it says going to recklessly handle any firearm.
Correct.
So maybe if you recklessly handle a BB and hurt somebody, that's something else. It's an assault. It's a whatever. But if a BB is not a firearm because it doesn't meet the traditional definition, why would we?
Well, because at the same time, Your Honor, under Starton, items for use of a firearm can be a replica or something else. So clearly, the statute's got multiple definitions of firearm. So again, a BB gun can be a firearm for 53.1, so it could also be a firearm for purposes of 56.1. It would not be a firearm under 308.2. A toy could be a firearm under 53.1, would not be a firearm under 308.2. That's just kind of the way the case law around the firearm has developed.
Now, if we were to conclude the definition is the same under 18.2308.2 and 18.256.1, I mean, does that create discrepancies there?
If 56.1 and 308.2 have the same definition of firearm?
Right.
I think there would be an appearance, possibly, of some type of inconsistency in the judge's verdict. I don't think it's necessarily fatal, because I still think because first of all, it was never argued to the trial judge, hey, you made a legal inconsistency in your decision. That issue was never presented to the trial court. So the trial court never had an opportunity to decide if that was what the judge was ultimately going to do. Second of all, just Again, as the court indicated, just in general, looking at the facts of this case, there's ample evidence to support the fact that this was an operable firearm that was actually discharged in the presence of Mr. Lee. It was recklessly handled.
There is no, as I understand it, there's no case law directly on point. I think we all agree on that. And so what we get into when we don't have any case law directly on point and we have two competing theories of liability, we sort of get into policy, which is something we try to avoid because we don't make law, but we have to consider policy. Why do you believe that from a policy standpoint, it's better to provide or to use the less stringent standard as opposed to the more stringent?
Well, I don't believe that everything under 53.1, which is the less stringent, is going to meet the definition for 56.1, which is the recklessly handling. Something that can't expel a projectile at all is likely never going to meet the definition under 56.1. But something that can project a projectile by means other than explosion can still cause a danger to life, limb, or property, which is the harm the statute's aimed to prevent. We don't want people out there handling things which can injure other people.
But throwing knives can gravely injure or kill, but the statute says firearm.
Correct, but it also says any firearm.
Right.
And the word firearm has been defined multiple ways under multiple statutes, which is not the statute, it's just the way the law is at this point. And my argument is that there are items which would meet part of 53.1, not 30.2, but would probably be under 56.1. And there's items, I think clearly everything under 308.2 would fall under 56.1. And I think some of the things in 53.1 would fall under 56.1. Not everything would. And I think the way to delineate is anything that can shoot a projectile.
We almost need a transparency.
It's a Venn diagram of sorts. Anything that can expel a projectile, I think, could be recklessly handled under the statute. It would be sufficient to convict. And so I think there is. It's not a strict 308.2 is the necessary have to be the definition. Because I think there are harms that would be needed to be avoided that would be firearms that don't meet that definition.
We go back to, maybe I just didn't understand your point or wasn't listening very well. How do you explain, as I was looking at this case, quite frankly, and I'll be honest with you, I could see how the judge could convict him of the other charge, but not this one, but not vice versa, from just sort of looking at it from a common sense standpoint.
I have read the motion to strike, and I have read the judge's ruling, and I know what the judge said. I have no idea why he said what he said.
Then I'm in good company.
I thought maybe there's a mistake of, what he inverted, but that's not what the...
Clearly the judge did what the judge did, and my job would be much easier if he hadn't done that, but I still think, even given the record that we have, because especially because the judge was never put on notice. Look, judge, you just made an inconsistent ruling. You need to figure this out. He never had an opportunity to correct it himself. And I think looking in isolation, given the fact that that issue is arguably defaulted, that there is ample evidence to support the fact.
Whose burden was it to alert the trial court that he had made an inconsistent determination? Because if I'm the defense counsel in the case, quite frankly, if I hear the judge say that in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, I got a winner here maybe down the road, so why am I going to raise this point to the trial judge? Wouldn't it maybe be the government's responsibility to say, judge, let me make sure that we're convicting under the proper statute here so that I can put you on notice?
I would think if the court's dismissing everything, then probably the government's going to have a burden to say, wait a second, judge, you just done something which may be in violation of the law. But if your client's been convicted, and the judge has already dismissed one, and it's unlikely the judge is going to bring it back, the judge, you just earlier said as a matter of law, he doesn't possess a firearm. You cannot now find that he recklessly handled something he couldn't have possessed. You can't convict him of that either. That was never argued to the judge. He just said, and there's also, I don't want to get overly technical, but his motion to renew the motion to strike, just as I want to renew my motion to strike, my client testified, you can believe what he said, he never had a gun. He never actually says I'm renewing my motion to strike for everything I said earlier. So there's some vagueness as to what the renewed motion, but even putting that aside, I think the burden's on the defendant. He's got to make the record for appeal. He's got to give the judge the opportunity to rule on the issue. He didn't do that. I understand there's an appearance of inconsistencies, and there's nothing I can do about that at this point other than argue what I've argued today. But I think it's clear he possessed a firearm. He recklessly handled it. He did. It was discharged in the presence of Mr. Lee, endangering his life, limb, and property. And the trial court did not err in convicting him of the charge. And I ask this court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Judge, that's something. Whenever I do a motion to strike, I always try to think back and look what I did. But I did notice on it would be 47, the appendix. After I had made my motion, made my arguments, Judge Dalton said, I overrule your objection. My response was, yes, sir. And his question, renew it at the conclusion for the same reasons. And I said, yes, sir. So I did. As far as bringing this up, obviously, I run the risk of being ineffective assistance of counsel, that's for sure, by saying, hey, you want to take a look at that felony again, Judge, that you found my client not guilty of. But I got quite a number of comments from Judge Dalton. Again, his main one is, I don't see a case that goes as far as what we're asking today.
You would agree, though, that if a jury did the same thing that the trial judge did, you would probably have a tougher road to go there.
It would. I just had a case come up before this court for the same issue. A judge had it was a bifurcated trial, same evidence. The judge found guilty of one. The jury comes back not guilty on others. Of course, my client looks at me saying, what? This is different, though. This is an inconsistent verdict, obviously, with the judge, but still, you've heard my arguments. I'm not asking for a third standard. It sounds like from Mr. Stallard, he's asking to pick and choose what applies. I'm simply asking to apply the standard in the felon possession of a firearm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.